28. Icarus. Jimmy had barely time to radio. "The wing's buckling. I'm going to crash," when Dragonfly started to fold up gracefully around him. The left wing snapped cleanly in the middle, and the outer section drifted away like a gently falling leaf. The right wing put up a more complicated performance. It twisted around at the root and angled back so sharply that its tip became entangled in the tail. Jimmy felt that he was sitting in a broken kite, slowly falling down the sky. Yet he was not quite helpless. The air screw still worked, and while he had power, there was still some measure of control. He had perhaps 5 minutes in which to use it. Was there any hope of reaching the sea? No, it was much too far away. Then he remembered that he was thinking in terrestrial terms. Though he was a good swimmer, it would be hours before he could possibly be rescued, and in that time the poisonous waters would undoubtedly have killed him. His only hope was to come down on land. The problem of the sheer southern cliff he would think about later, if there was any later. He was falling very slowly, here in this tenth of a gravity zone, but would soon start to accelerate as he got farther away from the axis. However, air drag would complicate the situation and would prevent him from building up too swift a rate of descent. Dragonfly, even without power, would act as a crude parachute. The few kilograms of thrust he could still provide might make all the difference between life and death. That was his only hope. Hub had stopped talking. His friends could see exactly what was happening to him and knew that there was no way their words could help. Jimmy was now doing the most skillful flying of his life. It was too bad, he thought with grim humor, that his audience was so small and could not appreciate the finer details of his performance. He was going down in a wide spiral, and as long as its pitch remained fairly flat, his chances of survival were good. His pedaling was helping to keep Dragonfly airborne, though he was afraid to exert maximum power in case the broken wings came completely adrift. And every time he swung southward, he could appreciate the fantastic display that Rama had kindly arranged for his benefit. The streamers of lightning still played from the tip of Bighorn down to the lesser peaks beneath, but now the whole pattern was rotating. The six-pronged crown of fire was turning against the spin of Rama, making one revolution every few seconds. Jimmy felt that he was watching a giant electric motor in operation, and perhaps that was not hopelessly far from the truth. He was halfway down to the plane, orbiting in a flat spiral, when the fireworks display suddenly ceased. He could feel the tension drain from the sky, and knew, without looking, that the hairs on his arms were no longer straining upright. There was nothing to distract or hinder him now, during the last few minutes of his fight for life. Now that he could be certain of the general area in which he must land, he started to study it intently. Much of this region was a checkerboard of totally conflicting environments, as if a mad landscape gardener had been given a free hand and told to exercise his imagination to the utmost. The squares of the checkerboard were almost a kilometer on a side, and though most of them were flat, he could not be sure if they were solid, because their colors and textures varied so greatly. He decided to wait until the last possible minute before making a decision, if, indeed, he had any choice. When there were a few hundred meters to go, he made a last call to the hub. "I've still got some control. We'll be down in half a minute. We'll call you then." That was optimistic. and everyone knew it. But he refused to say goodbye. He wanted his comrades to know that he had gone down fighting, and without fear. Actually, he felt little fear, and this surprised him, for he had never thought of himself as a particularly brave man. It was almost as if he were watching the struggles of a complete stranger, and was not himself personally involved. Rather, he was studying an interesting problem in aerodynamics, and changing various parameters to see what would happen. Almost the only emotion he felt was a certain remote regret for lost opportunities, of which the most important was the forthcoming Lunar Olympics. One future, at least, was decided. Dragonfly would never show her paces on the moon. 100 meters to go. His ground speed seemed acceptable, but how fast was he falling? And here was one piece of luck. The terrain was completely flat. He would put forth all his strength in a final burst of power, starting now. The right wing, having done its duty, finally tore off at the roots. Dragonfly started to roll over, and he tried to correct by throwing the weight of his body against the spin. He was looking directly at the curving arch of landscape 16 kilometers away when he hit. It seemed altogether unfair and unreasonable that the sky should be so hard. 29. First Contact. When Jimmy returned to consciousness, the first thing he became aware of was a splitting headache. He almost welcomed it. At least it proved that he was alive. Then he tried to move, and at once a wide selection of aches and pains brought themselves to his attention. But as far as he could tell, nothing seemed to be broken. After that, he risked opening his eyes, but closed them at once when he found himself staring straight into the band of light along the ceiling of the world. As a cure for a headache, that view was not recommended. He was still lying there, regaining his strength and wondering how soon it would be safe to open his eyes, when there was a sudden crunching noise from close at hand. Turning his head slowly toward the source of the sound, he risked a look and almost lost consciousness again. Not more than 5 meters away, a large, crab-like creature was apparently dining on the wreckage of poor Dragonfly. When Jimmy had recovered his wits, he rolled slowly and quietly away from the monster, expecting at every moment to be seized by its claws when it discovered that more appetizing fare was available. However, it took not the slightest notice of him. When he had increased their mutual separation to 10 meters, he cautiously propped himself up in a sitting position. From this greater distance, the thing did not appear quite so formidable. It had a low, flat body, about 2 meters long and 1 wide, supported on 6 triple-jointed legs. Jimmy saw that he was mistaken in assuming that it had been eating Dragonfly. In fact, he could not see any sign of a mouth. The creature was actually doing a neat job of demolition, using scissor-like claws to chop the skybike into small pieces. A whole row of manipulators, which looked uncannily like tiny human hands, then transferred the fragments to a steadily growing pile on the animal's back. But was it an animal? Though that had been Jimmy's first reaction, now he had second thoughts. There was a purposefulness about its behavior that suggested fairly high intelligence. He could see no reason why any creature of pure instinct should carefully collect the scattered pieces of his skybike, unless, perhaps, it was gathering material for a nest. Keeping a wary eye on the crab, which still ignored him completely, Jimmy struggled to his feet. A few wavering steps demonstrated that he could walk, though he was not sure if he could outdistance those six legs. Then he switched on his radio, never doubting that it would still be operating. A crash that he could survive would not even have been noticed by its solid-state electronics. "Hub control," he said softly, "can you receive me?" "Thank God, are you okay?" "Just a bit shaken. Take a look at this." He turned his camera toward the crab, just in time to record the final demolition of Dragonfly's wing. "What the devil is it? And why is it chewing up your bike?" "Wish I knew. It's finished with Dragonfly. I'm going to back away, in case it wants to start on me." Jimmy slowly retreated, never taking his eyes off the crab. It was now moving round and round in a steadily widening spiral, apparently searching for fragments it might have overlooked, and so Jimmy was able to get an overall view of it for the first time. Now that the initial shock had worn off, he could appreciate that it was quite a handsome beast. The name Crab, which he had automatically given to it, was perhaps a little misleading. If it had not been so impossibly large, he might have called it a beetle. Its carapace had a beautiful metallic sheen. He would almost have been prepared to swear that it was metal. That was an interesting idea. Could it be a robot and not an animal? He stared at the crab intently with this thought in mind, analyzing all the details of its anatomy. Where it should have had a mouth was a collection of manipulators that reminded Jimmy strongly of the multipurpose knives that are the delight of all red-blooded boys. There were pincers, probes, rasps, and even something that looked like a drill. But this was not decisive. On Earth, the insect world had matched all these tools, and many more. The animal or robot question remained in perfect balance in his mind. The eyes, which might have settled the matter, left it even more ambiguous. They were so deeply recessed in protective hoods that it was impossible to tell whether their lenses were made of crystal or of jelly. They were quite expressionless and of a startling vivid blue. Though they had been directed toward Jimmy several times, they had never shown the slightest flicker of interest. In his, perhaps, biased opinion, that decided the level of the creature's intelligence. An entity, robot or animal, which could ignore a human being, could not be very bright. It had stopped its circling and stood still for a few seconds, as if listening to some inaudible message. Then it set off, with a curious rolling gait, in the general direction of the sea. It moved in a perfectly straight line at a steady 4 or 5 kilometers an hour, and had already traveled a couple of 100 meters before Jimmy's still slightly shocked mind registered the fact that the last sad relics of his beloved dragonfly were being carried away from him. He set off in hot and indignant pursuit. His action was not wholly illogical. The crab was heading toward the sea, and if any rescue was possible, it could be only from this direction. Moreover, he wanted to discover what the creature would do with its trophy. That should reveal something about its motivation and intelligence. Because he was bruised and stiff, it took Jimmy several minutes to catch up with the purposefully moving crab. When he had done so, he followed it at a respectful distance until he felt sure that it did not resent his presence. It was then that he noticed his water flask and emergency ration pack among the debris of Dragonfly, and felt instantly both hungry and thirsty. There, scuttling away from him at a remorseless 5 kilometers an hour, was the only food and drink in all this half of the world. Whatever the risk, he had to get hold of it. He cautiously closed in on the crab, approaching from the right rear. While he kept station with it, he studied the complicated rhythm of its legs until he could anticipate where they would be at any moment. When he was ready, he muttered a quick, "Excuse me," and shot swiftly in to grab his property. Jimmy had never dreamed that he would one day have to exercise the skills of a pickpocket, but he was delighted with his success. He was out again in less than a second, and the crab never slackened its steady pace. He dropped back a dozen meters, moistened his lips from the flask, and started to chew a bar of meat concentrate. The little victory made him feel much happier. Now he could even risk thinking about his somber future. While there was life, there was hope. Yet he could imagine no way in which he could possibly be rescued. Even if his colleagues crossed the sea, how could he reach them 0.5 kilometer below?
"We'll find a way down somehow,"
Hub Control had promised.
"That cliff can't go right around the world without a break anywhere."
He had been tempted to answer, "Why not?" but had thought better of it. One of the strangest things about walking inside Rama was that you could always see your destination. Here, the curve of the world did not hide, it revealed. For some time, Jimmy had been aware of the crab's objective. Up there in the land that seemed to rise before him was a 0.5 kilometer wide pit. It was one of 3 in the southern hemisphere. From the hub, it had been impossible to see how deep they were. All had been named after prominent lunar craters, and he was approaching Copernicus. The name was hardly appropriate, for there were no surrounding hills and no central peaks. This Copernicus was merely a deep shaft, or well, with perfectly vertical sides. When he came close enough to look into it, Jimmy was able to see a pool of ominous, leaden-green water at least 0.5 kilometer below. This would put it just about level with the sea, and he wondered if they were connected. Winding down the interior of the well was a spiral ramp, completely recessed into the sheer wall, so that the effect was rather like that of rifling in an immense gun barrel. There seemed to be a remarkable number of turns. Not until Jimmy had traced them for several revolutions, getting more and more confused in the process, did he realize that there was not one ramp, but 3, totally independent and 120 degrees apart. In any other background than Rama, the whole concept would have been an impressive architectural tour de force. The 3 ramps led straight down into the pool and disappeared beneath its opaque surface. Near the waterline, Jimmy could see a group of black tunnels, or caves. They looked rather sinister, and he wondered if they were inhabited. Perhaps the Ramans were amphibious. As the crab approached the edge of the well, Jimmy assumed that it was going to descend one of the ramps, perhaps taking the wreckage of Dragonfly to some entity who would be able to evaluate it. Instead, the creature walked straight to the brink, extended almost 0.5 its body over the gulf without any sign of hesitation, though an error of a few centimeters would have been disastrous, and gave a brisk shrug. The fragments of Dragonfly went fluttering down into the depths. There were tears in Jimmy's eyes as he watched them go. So much, he thought bitterly, for this creature's intelligence. Having disposed of the garbage, the crab swung around and started to walk toward Jimmy, standing only about 10 meters away. Am I going to get the same treatment? He wondered. He hoped the camera was not too unsteady as he showed Hub Control the rapidly approaching monster. What do you advise? He whispered anxiously, without much hope that he would get a useful answer. It was some small consolation to realize that he was making history, and his mind raced through the approved patterns for such a meeting. Until now, all of these had been purely theoretical. He would be the first man to check them in practice. Don't run until you're sure it's hostile, Hub Control whispered back at him. Run where? Jimmy asked himself. He thought he could outdistance the thing in 100-meter sprint, but he had a sick certainty that it could wear him down over the long haul. Slowly, Jimmy held up his outstretched hands. Men had been arguing for 200 years about this gesture. Would every creature, everywhere in the universe, interpret this as, see, no weapons, but no one could think of anything better? The crab showed no reaction whatsoever, nor did it slacken its pace. Ignoring Jimmy completely, it walked straight past him and headed purposefully into the south. Feeling extremely foolish, the acting representative of Homo sapiens watched his first contact stride away across the Raman plain, totally indifferent to his presence. He had seldom been so humiliated in his life. Then his sense of humor came to the rescue. After all, it was no great matter to have been ignored by an animated garbage truck. It would have been worse if it had greeted him as a long-lost brother. He walked back to the rim of Copernicus and stared down into its opaque waters. For the first time, he noticed that vague shapes, some of them quite large, were moving slowly back and forth beneath the surface. Presently, one of them headed toward the nearest spiral ramp, and something that looked like a multi-legged tank started on the long ascent. At the rate it was going, Jimmy decided, it would take almost an hour to get here. If it was a threat, it was a very slow-moving one. Then he noticed a flicker of much more rapid movement near those cave-like openings down by the waterline. Something was traveling swiftly along the ramp, but he could not focus clearly upon it, or discern any definite shape. It was as if he was looking at a small whirlwind, or dust devil, about the size of a man. He blinked and shook his head, keeping his eyes closed for several seconds. When he opened them again, the apparition was gone. Perhaps the impact had shaken him up more than he had realized. This was the first time he had ever suffered from visual hallucinations. He would not mention it to Hub Control. Nor would he bother to explore these ramps, as he had half thought of doing. It would obviously be a waste of energy. The spinning phantom he had merely imagined seeing had nothing to do with his decision. Nothing at all, for, of course, Jimmy did not believe in ghosts. 30. The Flower. Jimmy's exertions had made him thirsty, and he was acutely conscious of the fact that in all this land there was no water that a man could drink. With the contents of his flask, he could probably survive a week. But for what purpose? The best brains of Earth would soon be focused on his problem, and doubtless Commander Norton would be bombarded with suggestions. But he could imagine no way in which he could lower himself down the face of that half-kilometer cliff. Even if he had a long enough rope, there was no place to which he could attach it. Nevertheless, it was foolish and unmanly to give up without a struggle. Any help would have to come from the sea, and while he was marching toward it, he could carry on with his job as if nothing had happened. No one else would ever observe and photograph the varied terrains through which he must pass, and that would guarantee a posthumous immortality. though he would have preferred many other honors. That was better than nothing. He was only 3 kilometers from the sea, as poor Dragonfly could have flown, but it seemed unlikely that he could reach it in a straight line. Some of the terrain ahead of him might prove too great an obstacle. That was no problem, however, because there were plenty of alternative routes. He could see them all, spread out on the great curving map that swept up and away from him on either side. He had plenty of time. He would start with the most interesting scenery, even if it took him off his direct route. About 1 kilometer away to the right was a square that glittered like cut glass, or a gigantic display of jewelry. It was probably this thought that triggered Jimmy's footsteps. Even a doomed man might reasonably be expected to take some slight interest in a few thousand square meters of gems. He was not particularly disappointed when they turned out to be quartz crystals, millions of them set in a bed of sand. The adjacent square of the checkerboard was rather more interesting. It was covered with an apparently random pattern of hollow metal columns, set close together and ranging in height from less than 1 to more than 5 meters. It was completely impassable. Only a tank could have crashed through that forest of tubes. Jimmy walked between the crystals and the columns until he came to the first crossroads. The square on the right was a huge rug or tapestry made of woven wire. He tried to prise a strand loose, but was unable to break it. On the left was a tessellation of hexagonal tiles, so smoothly inlaid that there were no visible joints between them. It would have appeared a continuous surface had the tiles not been colored all the hues of the rainbow. Jimmy spent many minutes trying to find 2 adjacent tiles of the same color to see if he could then distinguish their boundaries, but he could not find a single example of such a coincidence. As he did a slow pan right around the crossroads, he said plaintively to Hub Control, "What do you think this is? I feel I'm trapped in a giant jigsaw puzzle. Or is this the Ramen Art Gallery?"
"We're as baffled as you, Jimmy. But there's never been any sign that the Ramens go in for art. Let's wait until we have some more examples before we jump to any conclusions."
The 2 examples he found at the next crossroads were not much help. One was completely blank. A smooth, neutral gray, hard, but slippery to the touch. The other was a soft sponge, perforated with billions upon billions of tiny holes. He tested it with his foot, and the whole surface undulated sickeningly beneath him like a barely stabilized quicksand. At the next crossroads, he encountered something strikingly like a plowed field, except that the furrows were a uniform meter in depth, and the material of which they were made had the texture of a file or rasp. But he paid little attention to this, because the square adjacent to it was the most thought-provoking of all that he had seen. At last, there was something that he could understand, and it was more than a little disturbing. The entire square was surrounded by a fence, so conventional that he would not have looked at it twice had he seen it on Earth. There were posts, apparently of metal, 5 meters apart, with 6 strands of wire strung taut between them. Beyond this fence was a 2nd identical one, and beyond that, 1/3. It was another example of Rama redundancy. Whatever was penned inside this enclosure would have no chance of breaking out. There was no entrance, no gates that could be swung open to drive in the beast or beasts that were presumably kept here. Instead, there was a single hole, like a smaller version of Copernicus, in the center of the square. Even in different circumstances, Jimmy would probably not have hesitated, but now he had nothing to lose. He quickly scaled all 3 fences, walked over to the hole and peered into it. Unlike Copernicus, this well was only 50 meters deep. There were three tunnel exits at the bottom, each of which looked large enough to accommodate an elephant. And that was all. After staring for some time, Jimmy decided that the only thing that made sense about the arrangement was for the floor down there to be an elevator. But what it elevated, he was never likely to know. He could only guess that it was quite large, and possibly quite dangerous. During the next few hours, he walked more than 10 kilometers along the edge of the sea, and the checkerboard squares had begun to blur together in his memory. He had seen some that were totally enclosed in tent-like structures of wire mesh, as if they were giant bird cages. There were others that seemed to be pools of congealed liquid, full of swirl patterns. However, when he tested them gingerly, they were quite solid. And there was one so utterly black that he could not even see it clearly. Only the sense of touch told him that anything was there. Yet now, there was a subtle modulation into something he could understand. Ranging one after the other toward the south was a series of, no other word would do, fields. He might have been walking past an experimental farm on Earth. Each square was a smooth expanse of carefully leveled earth or dirt, the first he had ever seen in the metallic landscape of Rama. The great fields were virgin, lifeless, waiting for crops that had never been planted. Jimmy wondered what their purpose could be, since it was incredible that creatures as advanced as the Ramans would engage in any form of agriculture. Even on Earth, farming was no more than a popular hobby and a source of exotic luxury foods. But he could swear that these were potential farms, immaculately prepared. He had never seen dirt that looked so clean. Each square was covered with a great sheet of tough, transparent plastic. He tried to cut through it to obtain a sample, but his knife would barely scratch the surface. Farther inland were other fields, and on many of them were complicated constructions of rods and wires, presumably intended for the support of climbing plants. They looked bleak and desolate, like leafless trees in the depths of winter. The winter they had known must have been long and terrible indeed, and these few weeks of light and warmth might be only a brief interlude before it came again. Jimmy never knew what made him stop and look more closely into the metal maze to the south. Unconsciously, his mind must have been checking every detail around him. It had noticed, in this fantastically alien landscape, something even more anomalous. About a quarter of a kilometer away, in the middle of a trellis of wires and rods, glowed a single speck of color. It was so small and inconspicuous that it was almost at the limit of visibility. On Earth, no one would have looked at it twice. Yet undoubtedly, one of the reasons he had noticed it now was because it reminded him of Earth. He did not report to Hub Control until he was sure that there was no mistake, and that wishful thinking had not deluded him. Not until he was only a few meters away could he be completely sure that life as he knew it had intruded into the sterile, aseptic world of Rama. Here, blooming in lonely splendor at the edge of the southern hemisphere, was a flower. As he came closer, it was obvious to Jimmy that something had gone wrong. There was a hole in the sheathing that, presumably, protected this layer of dirt from contamination by unwanted life forms. Through this break extended a green stem, about as thick as a man's little finger, which twined its way up through the trellis work. A meter from the ground, It burst into an efflorescence of bluish leaves, shaped more like feathers than the foliage of any plant known to Jimmy. The stem ended, at eye level, in what he had first taken to be a single flower. Now he saw, with no surprise at all, that it was actually three flowers, tightly packed together. The petals were brightly colored tubes, about 5 centimeters long. There were at least 50 in each bloom, and they glittered with such metallic blues, violets, and greens that they seemed more like the wings of a butterfly than anything in the vegetable kingdom. Jimmy knew practically nothing about botany, but he was puzzled to see no trace of any structures resembling pistils or stamens. He wondered if the likeness to terrestrial flowers might be a pure coincidence. Perhaps this was something more akin to a coral polyp. In either case, it would seem to imply the existence of small, airborne creatures to serve either as fertilizing agents or as food. It did not really matter. Whatever the scientific definition, to Jimmy, this was a flower. The strange miracle, the un-Raman-like accident of its existence here, reminded him of all that he would never see again, and he was determined to possess it. That would not be easy. It was more than 10 meters away, separated from him by a latticework made of thin rods. They formed a cubic pattern, repeated over and over, less than 40 centimeters on a side. Jimmy would not have been flying skybikes unless he had been slim and wiry, so he knew he could crawl through the interstices of the grid. But getting out again might be quite a different matter. It would certainly be impossible for him to turn around, so he would have to retreat backward. Hub Control was delighted with his discovery when he had described the flower and scanned it from every available angle. There was no objection when he said, "I'm going after it." Nor did he expect there to be. His life was now his own, to do with as he pleased. He stripped off all his clothes, grasped the smooth metal rods, and started to wriggle into the framework. It was a tight fit. He felt like a prisoner escaping through the bars of his cell. When he had inserted himself completely into the lattice, he tried backing out again, just to see if there were any problems. It was considerably more difficult, since he now had to use his outstretched arms for pushing instead of pulling, but he saw no reason why he should get helplessly trapped. Jimmy was a man of action and impulse, not of introspection. As he squirmed uncomfortably along the narrow corridor of rods, he wasted no time asking himself just why he was performing so quixotic a feat. He had never been interested in flowers in his whole life. Yet now, he was gambling his last energies to collect one. It was true that this specimen was unique and of enormous scientific value, but he really wanted it because it was his last link with the world of life and the planet of his birth. Yet when the flower was within his grasp, he had sudden qualms. Perhaps it was the only flower that grew in the whole of Rama. Was he justified in collecting it? If he needed any excuse, he could console himself with the thought that the Ramans themselves had not included it in their plans. It was obviously a freak, growing ages too late, or too soon. But he did not really require an excuse, and his hesitation was only momentary. He reached out, grasped the stem, and gave a sharp jerk. The flower came away easily enough. He also collected 2 of the leaves before starting to back slowly through the lattice. Now that he had only 1 free hand, progress was extremely difficult, even painful, and he soon had to pause to regain his breath. It was then that he noticed that the feathery leaves were closing, and the headless stem was slowly unwinding itself from its supports. As he watched, with a mixture of fascination and dismay, he saw that the whole plant was steadily retreating into the ground, like a mortally injured snake crawling back into its hole. "I've murdered something beautiful," Jimmy said to himself. But then, Rama had killed him. He was only collecting what was his rightful due. 31. Terminal Velocity. Commander Norton had never yet lost a man, and he had no intention of losing one now. Even before Jimmy had set off for the South Pole, he had been considering ways of rescuing him in the event of accident. The problem had turned out to be so difficult, however, that he had found no answer. All that he had managed to do was to eliminate every obvious solution. How does one climb a half-kilometer vertical cliff, even in reduced gravity? With the right equipment and training, it would be easy enough. But there were no Python guns aboard Endeavor, and no one could think of any other practical way of driving the necessary hundreds of spikes into that hard, mirror surface. He had glanced briefly at more exotic solutions, some, frankly, crazy. Perhaps a simp, fitted with suction pads, could make the ascent. But even if this scheme was practical, how long would it take to manufacture and test such equipment, and to train a simp to use it? He doubted if a man would have the necessary strength to perform the feat. Then, there was more advanced technology. The EVA propulsion units were tempting, but their thrust was too small, since they were designed for zero-G operation. They could not possibly lift the weight of a man, even against Rama's modest gravity. Could an EVA thruster be sent up on automatic control, carrying only a rescue line? He had tried out this idea on Sergeant Myron, who had promptly shot it down. There were, the engineer pointed out, severe stability problems. They might be solved, but it would take a long time, much longer than they could afford. What about balloons? There seemed a faint possibility here, if they could devise an envelope and a sufficiently compact source of heat. This was the only approach that Norton had not dismissed when the problem suddenly ceased to be one of theory and became a matter of life and death, dominating the news in all the inhabited worlds. While Jimmy was making his trek along the edge of the sea, half the crackpots in the solar system were trying to save him. At Fleet Headquarters, all the suggestions were considered, and about 1 in 1,000 was forwarded to Endeavor. Dr. Carlisle Pereira's arrived twice, once via the survey's own network, and once by Planetcom, Rama Priority. It had taken the scientist approximately 5 minutes of thought, and 1 millisecond of computer time. At first, Norton thought it was a joke in very poor taste. Then he saw the sender's name and the attached calculations, and did a quick double-take. He handed the message to Carl Mercer. "What do you think of this?" he asked, in as non-committal a tone of voice as he could manage. Carl read it swiftly, then said, "Well, I'm damned. He's right, of course."
"Are you sure?"
"He was right about the storm, wasn't he? We should have thought of this. It makes me feel a fool."
"You have company. The next problem is, how do we break it to Jimmy?"
"I don't think we should. Until the last possible minute. That's how I'd prefer it if I was in his place. Just tell him we're on the way."
Though he could look across the full width of the cylindrical sea and knew the general direction from which Resolution was coming,
Jimmy did not spot the tiny craft until it had already passed New York. It seemed incredible that it could carry six men and whatever equipment they had brought to rescue him. When it was only a kilometer away, he recognized Commander Norton and started waving. A little later, the skipper spotted him and waved back.
"Glad to see you're in good shape, Jimmy," he radioed. "I promised we wouldn't leave you behind. Now do you believe me?"
Not quite, Jimmy thought. Until this moment, he had still wondered if this was all a kindly plot to keep up his morale. But the commander would not have crossed the sea just to say goodbye. He must have worked out something.
"I'll believe you, Skipper," he said, "when I'm down there on the deck. Now, will you tell me how I'm going to make it?"
Resolution was slowing down 100 meters from the base of the cliff. As far as Jimmy could tell, she carried no unusual equipment, though he was not sure what he had expected to see.
"Sorry about that, Jimmy, but we didn't want you to have too many things to worry about."
Now, that sounded ominous. What the devil did he mean? Resolution came to a halt, 50 meters out and 500 below. Jimmy had almost a bird's-eye view of the commander as he spoke into his microphone.
"This is it, Jimmy. You'll be perfectly safe, but it will require nerve. We know you've got plenty of that. You're going to jump."
500 meters?
"Yes, but at only half a G."
"So? Have you ever fallen 250 on Earth?"
"Shut up or I'll cancel your next leave. You should have worked this out for yourself. It's just a question of terminal velocity. In this atmosphere, you can't reach more than 90 kilometers an hour, whether you fall 200 or 2,000 meters. 90's a little high for comfort, but we can trim it some more. This is what you'll have to do, so listen carefully." "I will," said Jimmy.
"It had better be good."
He did not interrupt the commander again, and made no comment when Norton had finished. Yes, it made sense, and was so absurdly simple that it would take a genius to think of it, and, perhaps, someone who did not expect to do it himself. Jimmy had never tried high diving, or made a delayed parachute drop, which would have given him some psychological preparation for this feat. One could tell a man that it was perfectly safe to walk a plank across an abyss, yet even if the structural calculations were impeccable, he might still be unable to do it. Now, Jimmy understood why the commander had been so evasive about the details of the rescue. He had been given no time to brood or to think of objections.
"I don't want to hurry you," said Norton's persuasive voice from half a kilometer below. "But the sooner the better."
Jimmy looked at his precious souvenir, the only flower in Rama. He wrapped it carefully in his grimy handkerchief, knotted the fabric, and tossed it over the edge of the cliff. It fluttered down with reassuring slowness, but it also took a very long time, getting smaller and smaller and smaller, until he could no longer see it. But then Resolution surged forward, and he knew that it had been spotted.
"Beautiful," exclaimed the commander enthusiastically. "I'm sure they'll name it after you."
"Okay, we're waiting."
Jimmy stripped off his shirt, the only upper garment anyone ever wore in this now tropical climate, and stretched it thoughtfully. Several times on his trek, he had almost discarded it. Now, it might help to save his life. For the last time, he looked back at the hollow world he alone had explored, and the distant, ominous pinnacles of the Big and Little Horns. Then, grasping the shirt firmly with his right hand, he took a running jump as far out over the cliff as he could. Now, there was no particular hurry. He had a full 20 seconds in which to enjoy the experience. but he did not waste any time, as the wind strengthened around him, and resolution slowly expanded in his field of view. Holding his shirt with both hands, he stretched his arms above his head, so that the rushing air filled the garment and blew it into a hollow tube. As a parachute, it was hardly a success. The few kilometers an hour it subtracted from his speed were useful, but not vital. It was doing a much more important job, keeping his body vertical, so that he would arrow straight into the sea. He still had the impression that he was not moving at all, but that the water below was rushing up toward him. Once he had committed himself, he had no sense of fear. Indeed, he felt a certain indignation against the skipper for keeping him in the dark. Did he really think that he would have been scared to jump if he'd had to brood over it too long? At the last moment, he let go of his shirt, took a deep breath, and grabbed his mouth and nose with his hands. As he had been instructed, he stiffened his body into a rigid bar and locked his feet together. He would enter the water as cleanly as a falling spear. "It will be just the same," the commander had promised, "as stepping off a diving board on Earth. Nothing to it, if you make a good entry." "And if I don't?" he had asked. "Then you'll have to go back and try again." Something slapped him across the feet, hard, but not viciously. A million slimy hands were tearing at his body. There was a roaring in his ears, a mounting pressure, and even though his eyes were tightly closed, he could tell that darkness was falling as he arrowed down into the depths of the cylindrical sea. With all his strength, he started to swim upward toward the fading light. He could not open his eyes for more than a single blink. The poisonous water felt like acid when he did so. He seemed to have been struggling for ages, and more than once he had a nightmare fear that he had lost his orientation and was really swimming downward. Then he would risk another quick glimpse, and every time the light was stronger. His eyes were still clenched tightly shut when he broke water. He gulped a precious mouthful of air, rolled over on his back, and looked around. Resolution was heading toward him at top speed. Within seconds, eager hands had grabbed him and dragged him aboard. "Did you swallow any water?" was the commander's anxious question.
"I don't think so."
"Rinse your mouth out with this anyway." "That's fine. How do you feel?"
"I'm not really sure. I'll let you know in a minute."
"Oh, thanks, everybody." The minute was barely up, when Jimmy was only too sure how he felt.
"I'm going to be sick," he confessed miserably.
His rescuers were incredulous.
"In a dead calm? On a flat sea?" protested Sergeant Barnes, who seemed to regard Jimmy's plight as a direct reflection on her skill.
"I'd hardly call it flat," said the commander, waving his arm around at the band of water that circled the sky. "But don't be ashamed. You may have swallowed some of that stuff. Get rid of it as quickly as you can."
Jimmy was still straining, unheroically and unsuccessfully, when there was a flicker of light in the sky behind them. All eyes turned toward the South Pole, and Jimmy instantly forgot his sickness. The horns had started their fireworks display again. There were the kilometer-long streamers of fire, dancing from the central spike to its smaller companions. Once again they began their stately rotation, as if invisible dancers were winding their ribbons around an electric maypole. But now they began to accelerate, moving faster and faster, until they blurred into a flickering cone of light. It was a spectacle more awe-inspiring than any they had yet seen here, and it brought with it a distant crackling roar, which added to the impression of overwhelming power. The display lasted for about 5 minutes, then it stopped, as abruptly as if someone had turned a switch.
I'd like to know what the Rama Committee make of that, Norton muttered to no one in particular. Has anyone here got any theories? There was no time for an answer, because at that moment, Hub Control called in great excitement.
Resolution, are you okay? Did you feel that?
Feel what?
We think it was an earthquake. It must have happened the minute those fireworks stopped.
Any damage?
I don't think so. It wasn't really violent, but it shook us up a bit.
We felt nothing at all, but we wouldn't, out here in the sea.
Of course. Silly of me. Anyway, everything seems quiet now. Until next time.
Yes, until next time, Norton echoed. The mystery of Rama was steadily growing. The more they discovered about it, the less they understood. There was a sudden shout from the helm.
Skipper, look, up there in the sky.
Norton lifted his eyes and swiftly scanned the circuit of the sea. He saw nothing until his gaze had almost reached the zenith and he was staring at the other side of the world.
My God,
he whispered slowly as he realized that the next time was already almost here. A tidal wave was racing toward them down the eternal curve of the cylindrical sea. 32. The Wave. Even in that moment of shock, Norton's first concern was for his ship.
Endeavor, he called. Situation report.
All okay, Skipper,
was the reassuring answer from Exec.
We felt a slight tremor, but nothing that could cause any damage. There's been a small change of attitude. The bridge says about 0.2 degrees. They also think the spin rate has altered slightly. We'll have an accurate reading on that in a couple of minutes.
So it's beginning to happen, Norton said to himself. And a lot earlier than we expected. We're still a long way from perihelion and the logical time for an orbit change. But some kind of trim was undoubtedly taking place, and there might be more shocks to come. Meanwhile, the effects of this first one were all too obvious, up there on the curving sheet of water that seemed perpetually falling from the sky. The wave was about 10 kilometers away, and stretched the full width of the sea from northern to southern shore. Near the land, it was a foaming wall of white, but in deeper water, it was a barely visible blue line, moving much faster than the breakers on either flank. The drag of the shoreward shallows was already bending it into a bow, with the central portion getting farther and farther ahead.
Sergeant, said Norton urgently, this is your job. What can we do?
Sergeant Barnes had brought the raft completely to rest and was studying the situation intently. Her expression, Norton was relieved to see, showed no trace of alarm. Rather, a certain zestful excitement, like that of a skilled athlete about to accept a challenge.
I wish we had some soundings, she said.
If we're in deep water, there's nothing to worry about.
Then we're all right. We're about 4 kilometers from shore.
I hope so, but I want to study the situation.
She applied power again and swung Resolution around until it was just underway, heading directly toward the approaching wave. Norton judged that the swiftly moving central portion would reach them in less than 5 minutes, but he could also see that it presented no serious danger. It was only a racing ripple a fraction of a meter high, and would scarcely rock the boat. The walls of foam, lagging far behind it, were the real menace. Suddenly, in the very center of the sea, a line of breakers appeared. The wave had clearly hit a submerged wall, several kilometers in length, not far below the surface. At the same time, the breakers on the two flanks collapsed as they ran into deeper water. Anti-slosh plates, Norton told himself.
exactly the same as in Endeavour's own propellant tanks, but on a thousandfold greater scale. There must be a complex pattern of them all around the sea, to damp out any waves as quickly as possible. The only thing that matters now is, are we right on top of one?
Sergeant Barnes was one jump ahead of him. She brought resolution to a full stop and threw out the anchor. It hit bottom at only 5 meters.
"Haul it up," she called to her crewmates. "We've got to get away from here."
Norton agreed heartily. But in which direction? The sergeant was headed full speed toward the wave, which was now only 5 kilometers away. For the first time, he could hear the sound of its approach, a distant, unmistakable roar, which he had never expected to hear inside Rama. Then it changed in intensity. The central portion was collapsing again, and the flanks again were building up. He tried to estimate the distance between the submerged baffles, assuming that they were spaced at equal intervals. If he was right, there should be one more to come. If they could station the raft in the deep water between them, they would be perfectly safe. Sergeant Barnes cut the motor and threw out the anchor again. It went down 30 meters without hitting bottom.
"We're okay," she said, with a sigh of relief. "But I'll keep the motor running."
Now, there were only the lagging walls of foam along the coast. Out here in the central sea, it was calm again, apart from the inconspicuous blue ripple still speeding toward them. The sergeant was just holding resolution on course toward the disturbance, ready to pour on full power at a moment's notice. Then, only 2 kilometers ahead of them, the sea started to foam once more. It humped up in white-maned fury, and now its roaring seemed to fill the world. Upon the 16-kilometer high wave of the cylindrical sea, a smaller ripple was superimposed, like an avalanche thundering down a mountain slope. And that ripple was quite large enough to kill them. Sergeant Barnes must have seen the expressions on the faces of her crewmates. She shouted above the roar,
"What are you scared about? I've ridden bigger ones than this."
That was not quite true. Nor did she add that her earlier experience had been in a well-built surf boat, not an improvised raft.
"But if we have to jump, wait until I tell you. Check your life jackets."
"She's magnificent, like a Viking warrior going into battle, and obviously enjoying every minute," thought the commander. "And she's probably right, unless we've miscalculated badly."
The wave continued to rise, curving upward and over. The slope above them probably exaggerated its height, but it looked enormous, an irresistible force of nature that would overwhelm everything in its path. Then, within seconds, it collapsed, as if its foundations had been pulled out from underneath it. It was over the submerged barrier, in deep water again. When it reached them a minute later, resolution merely bounced up and down a few times before Sergeant Barnes swung her around and set off at top speed toward the north.
"Thanks, Ruby. That was splendid. But will we get home before it comes around for the second time?"
"Probably not. It will be back in about 20 minutes, but it will have lost all its strength then. We'll scarcely notice it."
Now that the wave had passed, they could relax and enjoy the voyage, though no one would be completely at ease until they were back on land. The disturbance had left the water swirling in random eddies, and had also stirred up a most peculiar acidic smell, like crushed ants, as Jimmy put it well. Though unpleasant, the odor caused none of the attacks of seasickness that might have been expected. It was something so alien that human physiology could not respond to it. A minute later, the wave front hit the next underwater barrier as it climbed away from them and up the sky. This time, seen from the rear, the spectacle was unimpressive, and the voyagers were ashamed of their previous fears. They began to feel themselves masters of the cylindrical sea. The shock was therefore all the greater when, not more than 100 meters away, something like a slowly rotating wheel began to rear up out of the water. Glittering metallic spokes, 5 meters long, emerged dripping, spun for a moment in the fierce Raman glare, and splashed back. It was as if a giant starfish with tubular arms had broken the surface. At first sight, it was impossible to tell whether it was an animal or a machine. Then it flopped over and lay half awash, bobbing up and down in the gentle aftermath of the wave. Now they could see that there were 9 arms, apparently jointed, radiating from a central disc. 2 of the arms were broken, snapped off at the outer joint. The others ended at a complicated collection of manipulators that reminded Jimmy strongly of the crab he had encountered. The 2 creatures came from the same line of evolution, or the same drawing board. At the middle of the disc was a small turret, bearing 3 large eyes. 2 were closed, 1 open, and even that appeared to be blank and unseeing. No one doubted that they were watching the death throes of some strange monster tossed up to the surface by the submarine disturbance that had just passed. Then they saw that it was not alone. Swimming around it and snapping at its still feebly moving limbs were 2 small beasts like overgrown lobsters. They were efficiently chopping up the monster, and it did nothing to resist, though its own claws seemed quite capable of dealing with the attackers. Again, Jimmy was reminded of the crab that had demolished Dragonfly. He watched intently as the one-sided conflict continued and quickly confirmed his impression.
"Look, Skipper," he whispered. "Do you see? They're not eating it. They don't even have any mouths. They're simply chopping it to pieces. That's exactly what happened to Dragonfly."
"You're right. They're dismantling it like a broken machine."
Norton wrinkled his nose.
"But no dead machine ever smelled like that."
Then another thought struck him.
"My God, suppose they start on us. Ruby, get us back to shore as quickly as you can."
Resolution surged forward with reckless disregard for the life of her power cells. Behind them, the 9 spokes of the great starfish, they could think of no better name for it, were clipped steadily shorter, and presently the weird tableau sank back into the depths of the sea. There was no pursuit, but they did not breathe comfortably again until Resolution had drawn up to the landing stage, and they had stepped thankfully ashore. As he looked back across that mysterious and now sinister band of water, Norton grimly determined that no one would ever sail it again. There were too many unknowns, too many dangers. He looked back upon the towers and ramparts of New York and the dark cliff of the continent beyond. They were safe now from inquisitive man. He would not tempt the gods of Rama again.